That was a disastrous ending of this podcast.
It really was. The worst yet. It's Friday, March the 8th, and this is the Dutch News Podcast, your weekly chance to catch up with what's been going on here in the Netherlands. I'm Gordon Darrow, Dutch News Contributing Editor and Fairy Tale Grenade Hurler, and I'm joined as usual by Paul Peters, Civil Engineer and Air Raid Siren Mourner.
Yes.
I think we should start with your job title, Paul.
No. We start with mentioning that spring has officially begun.
It has, yes.
Because the first kiwi egg has been found. Yeah, all across the country, we saw news items. Springing up, like tulips in spring, indeed. Of kiwi eggs being found everywhere. I think the first one was found in Utrecht, in the province of Utrecht.
There was a little bit of uphef about this, actually, because yeah, the first lapwing's egg, kiwit is the English name for kiwit is a lapwing, but we like the word kiwit, so we're going to keep calling them kiwits. The first kiwit egg was found in Bernia, in Gelderse. Then a couple of hours later, somebody in Grafhorst found a nest with two kiwit's eggs in. Now, that's interesting because kiwits only lay one egg a day. So by process of deduction, he said, well, this must be the first kiwit's egg of the of the year, but the organization who were in charge of identifying the first egg of the year, and I can't for the life of me, I'm trying to scrolling frantically to find out who it is. Anyway, they said no, it's the first one that's notified to us is the first kiwit's egg, even if you can deduce that there's actually one been lying in a nest since the day before.
So yeah, it's about finding the first kiwit egg, right? Yeah, that is the thing that matters, not necessarily when the first egg was laid.
Because you won't know that anyway. There might have been eggs laid somewhere else in other parts of the country that nobody finds until they hatch.
And then I saw another news item that the first kiwit egg was found in Friesland. So also there, spring has officially begun. So spring is everywhere.
Is springing up.
If you look. Yeah. Yeah, indeed. But if you look outside, then you get a different idea because it's not too nice a weather this week.
It's fine. Today was nice and bright. It's finally stopped raining. I don't mind it being cold as long as the sun's shining.
At least, yeah. Well, I didn't see a lot of sunshine, to be honest. But at least it's not raining. Yes, you're right. Kiwi eggs are popping up everywhere, and what we will probably not see anymore, not hear anymore in the future is the air raid siren.
No.
Because Dylan Jessogus has announced that she will stop using the sirens in case of emergencies from 2026, I believe.
Is it 26 or 25? I think
2026. Yeah, it says 2026.
Yeah, this has been mooted for a while, hasn't it? They've kept talking about switching them off, and then they decided that they're not ready. They want to switch to an alert, and
alert, which keeps failing, and it basically sends an emergency notification to people's mobile phones, but every time they test it, turns out that half of the people or something don't receive it, so it's not a watertight system. And what's also that's it. If you live in the Netherlands, this is a familiar sound, especially on the first Monday unless you are living in Limburg, this is you only hear this every first Monday of the month at noon. This will also mean when the air raid sirens will be phased out, that this will also mean the end of the monthly testing. And I think that's a bit of a shame because it's just one of these part of your rhythm, right, over the years. I mean, you hear it and you are reminded that it is a new month again.
It's always the first Monday in the month, and it's become such a routine thing that people almost you almost forget about it. And then the number of times that you see live news broadcasts which are interrupted by the sirens because they just forget that that it's midday on the first Monday and they should wait 5 minutes before they do the interview, and then suddenly you hear it go off in the background. And also whenever you have visitors, they always kind of get really shocked by it, and then they say, did you hear that noise? It was air raid siren day. Sorry, I forgot to warn you.
Because that was it is, of course, a remnant from the Cold War when nuclear threats were a thing that that could happen every day. I mean, we sort of returned to that bit of history in recent years somewhat, but Elon Jeskus feels that this is outdated technology and we should get rid of it. But yeah, a lot of experts have said that depending on your mobile phone network is probably not a wise thing because it can be hacked quite easily, as we've seen. We've seen reports security services warning that this is a plausible scenario that hostile powers can do something like that. And an emergency sound needs to be heard of, people should be alerted of something, then, and they first hack the mobile phone network, exactly, then there's no way of contacting your civilians. So this is a watertight system, because you need a firefighter, right, who needs to press the button, but it is its own radio network. It has backup batteries everywhere, so it is a flawless system in case of any type of emergency. The sirens can still be sounded. So it is. And not only from a nostalgic point of view, I think it's a shame that they will get rid of it, but it is also very useful.
Yeah, it is a potential security issue, right, if the network is taken down. Yeah, and I wonder what they're going to do as well with all the distinctive siren masts once they stop using them. Are they going to auction them off? Are people going to be... They're like the red phone boxes in Britain. People are going to be able to put them up in their gardens or something, or use them to grow plants up or something. I don't know.
That's an interesting idea, I think. Yeah. I was once on top of the new church in Delft when the air raid siren started to sound, and I think there's one on top of the church tower there, and I was surrounded by Americans and by Germans and by French people who all were wondering what the hell was happening. But I had to assure them that it was only a test. But, those are always funny things to see. Speaking of security risks,
Gordon,
what have you been up to in the Efteling?
I have not been to the Efteling. I deny being anywhere near the Efteling this this week. But somebody's been up to something, because although not recently, because somebody found a grenade in the Dornröschen, the Sleeping Beauty attraction in the Efteling. I always thought that Sleeping Beauty was put to sleep after pricking a finger on a pin. But so this is kind of a slightly more maybe modern take on the fairy tale. I don't know.
It is a pin related, I guess.
It is a different kind of pin. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think I don't. Yeah. I'm not sure that she'd just go to sleep for 100 years if she put her finger on this one. Anyway, it was a grenade, and rather worryingly, Omroep Brabant, when they first reported on this, because the Efteling is in Brabant, left out the word old. So they just said that a grenade had been found. And obviously, in the last couple of years, a lot of hand grenades have turned up, particularly on plumbers' doorsteps in Vlaardingen. So hearing that a hand grenade had been discovered in a children's or a family theme park was sent out quite alarming messages, particularly as, of course, it's Geert Wilders' favourite place in the whole world.
Oh, that's right.
Really,
the Droomvlucht. Which sounds a bit like Doornroosje, I guess. So maybe, maybe someone would mistakenly. Yeah, it was a vergisgranaat, probably.
But anyway, it turns out this was actually an historic wartime grenade that was discovered during building works as well. So it's not like some passing child had found a hand grenade and mistaken it for, I don't know, for a toy from a lucky meal or something. Somebody who was carrying out work in the park discovered the grenade, and it was the bomb disposal squad came along and made it safe. But quite a story that did the rounds.
This week's ophef came after the SGP discovered the cabinet wanted to scrap the word mother from the population registry and replace it with the parent who gave birth. The fundamentalist Protestant MP André Vlach discovered the proposed change in a number of amendments to existing laws in a process that's usually concerned with grammatical mistakes and wording. He called the Algemeen Dagblad to raise the alarm, and the newspaper ran with the smoking headline, "Cabinet wants to scrap mother," which naturally went absolutely viral on Tuesday.
Of course it did.
And gave birth to what became known as Mothergate. Ministerial officials wrote in the accompanying advice that they didn't expect the change to cause a lot of opposition, but Vlach said the change wasn't at all technical or uncontroversial, but instead a very sensitive one. These types of amendments are usually automatically approved by the Tweede Kamer, so that led to even more outrage by Vlach and others, who suspected that the cabinet was trying to sneak its wokeness into law this way. Vlach initially demanded a debate to try to scrap the mother scrapping, but Interior Affairs Minister Hugo de Jonge soon responded to the ophef on Twitter. He said that the proposed change was a mistake and that he will fix it as soon as possible. Mother is a splendid word, he said, and deserves a place in our laws.
Mm. So this was a bit of a storm in a teacup, really, wasn't it? It's
definitely.
Yeah, basically, some official had wanted. I think the idea was to give this slightly clumsy phrase about person who's given birth as an alternative option for people who maybe had children and then subsequently transitioned and were now registered as a different sex, and maybe the word mother was a bit awkward. But there was never any suggestion it was going to replace the word mother. So no. Once again, it's kind of like the end. It's the SKP, the Fundamental Christian Party, picked this up and said it was some kind of great secret clandestine woke agenda to replace words like mother and neutralize everything. And again, it's kind of funny to see people who go around policing wokeness and actually it's always there. They're always the ones who are triggered by very trivial things that turn out to have quite rational explanations.
It was only meant as a as an alternative and not as a full replacement.
Not as a full replacement, but somehow in the course of drafting legislation, this phrase kind of became the norm when that was never the intention. And Hugo de Jonge said after looking at it for 5 minutes that that they would put it right. So the whole storm quickly died down. There's still, you'll see people on Twitter trying to claim the government is secretly trying to abolish motherhood somehow. And that we're in some kind of weird...
It was classic ophef, though.
It was classic ophef, absolutely classic ophef, and it was very enjoyable. This week, we're drifting towards yet another milestone date in the bogged-down coalition talks. The outgoing government launches Operation Beethoven to keep one of the big dogs of the Dutch economy on the leash. Croatian bus drivers are being recruited in Limburg, and Dutch athletes win a clutch of medals at the World Indoor Championships in Glasgow. And we'll tell you how Amsterdam's transport operator pursued the post-war German state for Anne Frank's last tram fare. It's an amazing story.
This is a wild sentence, but it is also very true. So stay tuned for this amazing story.
So Groundhog Day is coming round again in the never-ending negotiations to form a new Dutch government. Kim Putters, the head of the Social and Economic Council, is due to deliver his report on the chances of forming some kind of cabinet with the four right-wing parties. And as we were literally recording this on Thursday evening, there was some breaking news. For once, it didn't break about half an hour after we'd finished recording.
It's still inconvenient, though, Kim Putters. So
it's massively inconvenient, and I think we'll be writing him a memo. And perhaps chasing him up for the cost of our travel expenses as well. So the Kim Putters came out on Thursday evening, he didn't. The NOS quoted sources in The Hague, so it's not actually official. But it seems to be the four parties have now agreed to form some kind of cabinet, but it's still very much up in the air exactly what form of cabinet it is, because the talks for the last 3 weeks since Putters took over from Ronald Plasterk have all been about how these parties could actually fit together, given that Peter Omtzigt's NSA doesn't want to go into government with Geert Wilders' PVV, and the VVD, the Liberal Party led by Dylan Jesselgers, now favour being in an extra parliamentary cabinet because they don't want to be in a cabinet or in a coalition, a majority coalition with the PVV either, and they'll only go in a minority coalition if NSA are involved as well. Well, it's all incredibly complicated. Who's going to go in with who, what form it's going to take, and it's still unclear exactly how it is. But the word is that Kim Putters has managed to persuade the four parties to at least keep talking, because next week he is due to deliver his report to Parliament. And it's really unclear, what exactly is going to be contained in it. Peter Omtzigt of NSA says the differences between him and Geert Wilders on constitutional rights are too great, and that's why he pulled out of the first round of talks a few weeks ago and said he wouldn't sit round the table with the other three. Ideal and Yeshel goes that the Feifei Day is not keen on Omzik's idea of a minority cabinet with the other three parties. Meanwhile, Geert Wilders and Karin van der Plas are still saying they would much prefer just a regular, straightforward majority coalition of all four parties. But that idea seems dead in the water as well. So for that reason, Kim Putters hasn't been able to actually have a meeting with all four parties at any stage of this four-week process. On Monday, he met Omtzigt and Yeşilgöz in the morning, followed by Wilders and van der Plas in the afternoon. Then on Tuesday, he sat down with Wilders and Omtzigt separately. And on Wednesday, Yeşilgöz and van der Plas had individual meetings. And I was just kind of curious what those particular combinations might suggest, because obviously Geert Wilders and Peter Omtzigt have not been in a room together since Ronald Plasterk passed on the duty as informateur, which I thought was quite interesting.
That's right, yeah. when Peter Omtzigt used the Plasterk's chauffeured car to meet with journalists to inform them first about his decision to step out of the coalition talks rather than informing his the other three parties and the informateur first. What it means, I think, is that Kim Putters realizes that there are basically just no other options available other than these four parties. They need to find some sort of way to cooperate together, because any other combination is just not feasible, either a minority version or a majority version. So I think Kim Putters really tried to make them realize this, and this is also what the NOS report says now. These four parties realize there's no other option, so they need to find a way, and that is that is probably not a good basis for these four parties to find to work on a coalition, because that's also what happened with the last cabinet, right?
Exactly,
these four parties, there was no other option, so they had to work together and see what happened from that.
Cabinet only lasted just over 2 years before it collapsed. So distrust is usually a very bad basis for a cabinet. And the NOS report does say as well that this is going to be an extra parliamentary cabinet, and we still don't really know what that means, but the idea, it seems to be, is that all four parties will contribute or propose ministers to sit in this cabinet, but some of them may come from outside the political arena, and there will not be such a strong link between the four parties that support the cabinet and the actual minister sitting in it.
Speaking of these other options, what are the options that are not feasible anymore?
If this combination, of course, it's not a done deal that these four parties will actually manage to put a cabinet together.
No.
They're only just starting the process of actually sitting down and negotiating a coalition agreement. They haven't even begun
When was the election again?
Yeah, we're now on day 106, and we're up to the ninth longest negotiation already, and they haven't even got down to got as far as drawing up a policy document. I think next week we're going to overtake another two. So we're well on the way to the record of 299 days set by the previous cabinet, the fourth Rutte cabinet. So if these four right-wing parties don't actually manage to do a deal, then the obvious thing is to look to the second largest party, which is GroenLinks PVDR. But of course, that's not really obvious at all, because Geert Wilders is absolutely adamantly against it, and as a party with 37 seats in opposition, he's going to make life very, very difficult indeed. Also, the PVD and NSA would both be needed. We both need to agree to join that particular cabinet, and again, I think Wilders has already indicated through his social media posts that he will make sure that they get the blame for the fact that Timmermans is prime minister. And of course, there's a sizable proportion of members and voters for the Feifei Day who are dead against forming a cabinet with GroenLinks and Partei van de Arbeid. So that is a mathematically feasible option, but really, I think it only comes into play and if the if all options with the four parties who are currently negotiating are exhausted. And Timmermans himself has said that as well. He said it partly because he says, I'm a Democrat, I have to accept the election result. I didn't win I'm not the biggest party, the PFF is, so they get first refusal. But also as a kind of tactical thing, I think he knows that if he goes too early, if he jumps in before Wilders is seen to have demonstrably failed, then there will be a huge backlash against him.
Yeah, and first this option to go over left, that doesn't reflect the outcome of the election. So first the other option needs to be exhausted intensively before this can be a reasonable option again.
But of course, I mean, we have a proportional system, and any combination that has half the seats in parliament does have the support that does reflect the election result. The only thing is, obviously, excluding the biggest party is a very unusual step, especially when they are so far ahead as the PFF are. So they would have to have conclusively failed before you can move on to the second largest party.
Do we need to mention the rumors that came out about Pieter Omtzigt?
Yeah, I think we should. Yes, because I think we've been talking about the lack of trust between the parties, and once again, rumors have been swirling around The Hague that Pieter Omtzigt had been throwing tantrums during the negotiation talks. He'd been banging the table. He'd been bursting into tears. We don't know where these rumors come from, but it's clearly someone else who was in the room. And again, Omtzigt himself said when he addressed the cameras before the talks this week it wasn't helpful. He refused to comment. The other party leaders as well, of course, toed the line, said that this wasn't really relevant. But of course, because these meetings all take place behind closed doors, any scrap of gossip that comes out it becomes a feeding frenzy for the media, and the people in the room know that. They know that if they leak any kind of details, it's going to make headline news. So,
And I think it also confirms, these kind of rumors that we've seen in the past years about Pieter Omtzigt as well. So, if you want to damage him, then this is a good way to bring out these kind of rumors, because it confirms some of the images other people had about him in the past years. Remember when Pieter Omtzigt was in a race to become the leader of the CDA, all of a sudden you heard rumors in the media about how he operated as an MP. Basically, you heard the same rumors that he was making tantrums, that he was emotional, that he was slamming doors and stuff like that. That was in 2021?
2021, wasn't it? Yes, it was during the pandemic.
So 3 years ago. So a lot of people have that still in the back of their head, and when you hear rumors like that you think, oh, that's plausible because we heard that before. It is obvious where this comes from. These are one or two or three of the other parties, and if you need to build trust, what you need in order to build a coalition, then this is not, I think, the way to bring Pieter Omtzigt back on board. But it happened again.
It happened again, it's disrespectful, really, isn't it? And Omtzigt will not take kindly to it, and it does undermine the relationship between the four parties. So it doesn't make the process of building this already fragile coalition any easier.
The cabinet has set up a secret operation to keep chip machinery maker ASML in the Netherlands, according to the Telegraaf on Wednesday. ASML recently confirmed to ministers that expanding abroad or leaving the country altogether is an option, and with Operation Beethoven, the cabinet is looking at what needs to be done to prevent the multi-billion dollar company from leaving.
Do we know why it was called Operation Beethoven?
No, I don't know why. I read somewhere the reason why they called it Beethoven. It was an enormously stupid reason, but I can't seem to find it again. So I don't know why they called it, but there was some sort of reasoning.
We tried to look it up as well, and we couldn't find it. So if anybody out there knows, then ping us a message, and we'll tell everybody next week.
Yeah, if ASML leaves the Netherlands, it would be a major economic and strategic blow for the Netherlands, especially now that Shell and Unilever had recently moved their headquarters from The Hague and Rotterdam to London. Last month, ASML chief executive Peter Wenning had made it clear that the company is concerned about some aspects of Dutch policies, such as the decision to reduce the 30% tax cut granted to some workers brought in from abroad. There's also the prospect of a right-wing government led by a far-right prime minister that wants to reduce the number of migrants, including highly skilled ones from outside the EU. That's also regarded as a serious problem by ASML, because some 40% of the company's 23,000 strong workforce comes from abroad. We also have the housing shortage. It's also considered an issue. And Prime Minister Mark Rutte and Economic Affairs Minister Mickey Adriaanse met for an hour on Wednesday, at which the Netherlands business climate was discussed. Wenning said afterwards that it was a good conversation, and he added that ASML is not planning to leave the country, but that is indeed a major gap between what ASML on the one hand and politicians on the other think is necessary for the Netherlands.
Yeah. So is this going to culminate in ASML sending a text message to the Prime Minister saying that they're quitting the country? Even after the new coalition has inserted some kind of law into the coalition agreement designed to keep them, as Rutte did with the dividend blasting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the fact that Wenning was invited at the Torentje, right? That is, it shows that the Dutch government, the highest ranking politicians, are taking this threat very seriously.
Yeah, or panicking, which is another possible interpretation.
So the Telegraaf reported that Operation Beethoven was some sort of secret operation by the government, but Mickey Adriaanse, the Economic Affairs Minister, confirmed to BNN News Radio that the existence of Operation Beethoven. Mm-hmm. She confirmed that the cabinet is indeed looking at ways to ensure that the Netherlands remains attractive for tech companies. And they're doing that every day, she said. There's no question of ASML leaving the Netherlands, but we have to be alert to the opportunities we have and to make most of them. Henk Volderbaar, who is a professor in strategy and innovation at Amsterdam Business Schools, however, feels that recent policies are making the Netherlands less attractive for big businesses. He calls the cabinet's plan to reduce the scope of the 30% ruling, we already mentioned that, but he calls it madness if the Netherlands wants to remain a highly skilled economy. And limiting the number of university bachelor degrees taught in English will also lead to fewer foreign students coming to the Netherlands. And he says that the number of highly skilled workers who can be trained in the Netherlands is simply not enough to keep all these companies running.
Yeah, so reducing the 30% ruling for expats seems to be not such a good idea all of a sudden.
No.
So the Dutch government has got to choose between, do you want to have this, keep this 30% ruling that you've been campaigning against for months and months, or do you want to lose a couple of major international employers? Because obviously, the reality is the Dutch economy is a very connected and well-connected and open economy, one of the most open in Europe. And that's sort of what the 30% rule is about. So, yeah, who would have thought that knee-jerk populist policy would end up rebounding on the politicians who proposed it?
I finally found the reason why it was called Operation Beethoven. Mickey Adriaanse said that there was an official at the ministry who was very creative, she says. She came up with the name, and Beethoven, the composer, made very nice things, just like ASML did.
Okay. Did Beethoven get the 30% ruling?
No, but he did get the Fifth Symphony.
He did,
which was also called the Noodlot Symphony. I see here now. What's Noodlot? That's
Desperation Symphony. No, it's not quite Desperation Symphony.
Fate, but in a negative with a negative connotation, right?
The Doomed Symphony or something.
Exactly. Yeah, and Beethoven went deaf at the end of his year, so I don't think Beethoven is a good. Good,
he's not a good advert for technology, is he? No. I mean, he ended up sawing the legs off his piano, so, you know, which is not really a high-tech solution to deafness.
Beethoven was of Dutch descent, though.
His of course, name was Van Beethoven
yeah, and not yeah. Von Beethoven, as some people seem to think.
Yeah. And of course, while the Castolp in The Hague was reeling from the ASML bombshell, it got hit by another bombshell. Was this a grenade that flew in from the Efteling?
Possibly. No, this bombshell came from Papendrecht, of all places, because that's where dredging and maritime service company Boskalis is headquartered. And they announced on Thursday it will partly move its headquarters operations to the Middle East. Later this year, the multi-billion dollar company will decide on a definitive departure from the Netherlands. Boskalis will set up its regional headquarters in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. And its CEO, Peter Berdowski, told The Telegraph that the decision is logical, given that the company does a lot of international operations. I think it was Boskalis who also made the Palm Islands in Dubai. So they're doing a lot of work there in the United Arab Emirates. But he says that Parliament's plans to limit the number of highly skilled workers moving to the Netherlands has pushed Boskalis over the edge in their decision to move their headquarters.
Did they also mention the 30% ruling? I think I read that they did in this...
I'm sure they did as well, but they also said that there are new sustainability laws coming up, which would lead to a lot of court cases against them. So that was another reason to consider moving to. So it's not all very nice reasons, to be honest.
No, and they mentioned the bureaucracy as well. I think they complained it takes two years to get a license, whereas in Dubai you can get a license within a couple of the snap of your fingers, basically. So
a working permit.
For
someone from abroad, if you can get it, they also said, so it can take 2 years, and then it is even not certain that they've got everything in order to bring someone to the Netherlands. And they say in the Middle East we have a window on all of Asia and an endless supply of talent, so it is a logical step for Boskalis to move their operations there. And plenty of sand, and they love their sand.
They love the sand. But it's a good opportunity for them as well to take a swipe at the Dutch government on the way out, I suppose.
Yeah.
The United Nations Special Rapporteur on Housing has called on Dutch politicians to stop blaming migrants for the housing crisis. Balarekstran and Rajagopal said decades of housing policy, rather than foreigners, were to blame for the long waiting lists for social housing. He refuted claims made during last year's election campaign that asylum seekers, migrant workers and international students were responsible for the shortage, and he said the government should actively counter the incitement of hatred against foreigners who've been blamed for the housing crisis. Rather than posing a competition to Dutch nationals when it comes to access to adequate housing, these groups mostly find themselves at the bottom of the society, competing for housing which most Dutch citizens are either not eligible for or would not wish to move into, he wrote in a 19-page report. So basically,
is he talking about Flevoland?
Or possibly Westland? I don't know. And basically saying that migrant workers are accommodation in pretty awful, basic, Spartan conditions that that Dutch people would turn their noses up at. While well-paid expats do drive up house prices in some areas, this is not the cause of the general housing crisis, he said. Government policies such as taxing social housing corporations, two-year rental contracts, and facilitating speculative buying in the housing market were bigger factors. But he said an alternative narrative has emerged in the Netherlands that an influx of foreigners arriving in the country is responsible for the crisis, which has been exploited for political ends and has radicalized and divided public opinion.
And initially the Dutch government was very welcoming for Ukrainians fleeing the war, but that has changed a bit now, right?
Yes, it changed because a lot of Ukrainians are quite well settled because of the very positive regime they had. They didn't have to apply for work visas. They had basically the same rights as EU citizens, and they also were not obliged to pay take out health insurance or pay for board and lodging or even their gas, electricity and water bills, which all seemed quite reasonable when they just literally fled a conflict zone and arrived next to nothing. But of course, in the meantime, about half of Ukrainians are now working, and the feeling is that they should be really contributing more towards their own upkeep. So this week, junior asylum minister Erik van den Burg agreed and announced that in the short term, Ukrainians will have to pay 105 euros a month towards the cost of electricity, gas and water, and 242 euros if they're living in accommodation where their meals are provided. So it's towards the cost of food. But he rejected the idea of a means-tested payment because that would be bureaucratically complicated, probably start another Tuslachen affair at the same time. And also many Ukrainians are working on short-term contracts or they have a variable income, so it would be very, very hard to calculate. And he said Ukrainians won't be asked to contribute to the cost of their accommodation because those payments could be seen as rent, and that would give them tenants' rights. And in the Netherlands, people have quite strong tenants' rights, but lots of people took in Ukrainians in their spare room or their back garden, and affording them tenants' rights would make it a much more legally complicated relationship.
And there's also some figures on stop and search by the police.
Yes, in news that will surprise absolutely nobody, it turns out that people with foreign backgrounds are more likely to be stopped by the police in the street. One in three young people whose parents were born in Morocco had been stopped in the last year, against one in five white Dutch people. The figures are almost as high for people with Turkish and Syrianese parents, and these numbers were included in the statistics agency CBS's annual public safety monitor, and it's the first time the survey has asked people about police checks.
And speaking of groups of migrants, there's a specific group that are moving to Limburg.
A specific group moving to a specific place in Limburg, which was a very enjoyable story. The bus company Arriva says it's struggling to recruit enough drivers in the southern province. So the provincial government is planning to relax the rule, which says that all bus drivers in the Netherlands must speak Dutch. Four Croatian drivers, who all speak English, are set to start work shortly, and more could follow if the pilot is a success. Arriva have had to agree to provide Dutch language training to the drivers and pay them the same rate as their colleagues who are covered by collective bargaining, so that the company isn't using migrant workers to undercut its own staff. Mm. But the nice detail here is that it's a place where these four Croatian bus drivers who don't speak Dutch are going to be working.
Are they going to work in Venlo?
They're
going to
work in Venlo, yes, which of course is Geert Wilders' hometown.
Yes.
Already we're seeing that they're going to open the border, which is quite near Venlo, of course. They're going to open the border and let migrants come in and drive our buses and take. Well, you can't really say take our jobs, because the whole reason that they're being offered work is that Dutch people are taking the jobs. And I don't think Kevillers travels by bus either. Speaking of recruiting, there are absolutely no restrictions on who can become a patron of the Dutch News podcast. In fact, we actively encourage people from far and wide to join our select band of members. For as little as $1 or €1 a month, you get a shout out on the podcast, the chance to ask us a question, and access to all our bonus content, as well as the deep satisfaction of knowing that you're helping us to help you make sense of whatever's going on here in the Netherlands. And this week we've recorded a special episode focusing on Lelystad Airport. So if you've ever walked for hours through Schiphol, wishing you could be somewhere smaller, more modern, and in Flavorland, an unlikely idea, I know. But if you've ever wondered that, then you can become a sponsor and listen to our special episode on Lelystad Airport and find out why the plan to open a commercial airport in the Polder went so disastrously wrong.
Yeah, and we have also bonus episodes on the Delta Works, on the Marengo trial. There is a bunch of other special episodes, so definitely worth checking out. And we're going to do a bonus episode every month. And if you have any suggestions on which topics we should cover, then please send that to podcast@dutchnews.nl or message one of us on Twitter. Maybe we will discuss your suggestion.
Yeah, so I think our next bonus episode is going to be is in response to a suggestion that a couple of our listeners came up with. We'll tell you about that close to the time. We have four tiers of membership, which are tailored for everybody's every budget. This week, we say welcome and thank you to one new patron, Kelsey Jensen. So thank you very much to you for coming on board. Let us know if there's anything you want to ask us. The same goes for all our patrons. If you've got any questions, drop us a line. And if you would like to become a patron, you can log on to www.patreon.com. That's patreon.com/DutchNewsNL.
Amsterdam public transport company GVB chased Germany for the cost of taking Jews to the station long after the war was over. An invoice uncovered at the War Documentation Institute NIOT shows that Nazi Germany never paid the municipal transport company for renting a tram that brought Jews from a local prison to the train station ahead of their transportation to concentration and death camps. The Germans hired the Amsterdam trams a total of 900 times at 10 guilders a ride, for which the GVB would invoice the Nazis every month. The last tram, hired on August 8, 1944, included Anne Frank and her family, but the 80 guilders invoice was never paid, and the GVB went so far to hire a debt collection agency to reclaim the money 2 years after the war.
Can you imagine being the debt collector who had to try and collect that debt? You know, so just turning up on somebody's doorstep said, are you aware that you know, that you still haven't paid for this tram that took hundreds of Jews to their death?
It's just ridiculous. Yeah. The invoices were found by author Guus Luiters while researching the prosecution of Jews in Amsterdam during the war. He called the fact that the GVB continued to chase the Germans for money after the war astounding. It's not clear where the GVB sent the post-war invoice, but during the war they sent it to the Gestapo based in The Hague. Maybe they sent it to South America. I don't know. probably a bunch of them walking around at that time. According to Houwing ten Katen, both the GVB as an organization and the individual tram drivers have been complicit in Nazi war crimes. The drivers could see with their own eyes that the trams were guarded by German police carrying guns. They understood these peoples were taking against their will, that they were in the power of their deadly enemies. They understood they were being sent to transit camps and then would never be heard from again. It comes down to aiding the enemy, he said, although he conceded that drivers would have had little choice but to collaborate. The GVB never apologized for their role in the persecution of the Jews by the Nazis during the war.
Really, it was a wrong compounding another wrong, wasn't it? First of all, the fact they collaborated with the Nazis in transporting the Jews, and after that, they still tried to profit from the enterprise by chasing the Germans for the money.
We have to say it was profitable for the GVB to rent these trams to the Nazis, and and even that 80 guilders wasn't a huge amount of money. No. So there was no incentive for them to chase this invoice. It just shows how greedy the municipal transportation company was at that time.
And just it's that just kind of horrible sense of it's of bureaucratic stubbornness, isn't it? We've got this receipt, we're going to make damn well sure it's paid, even though, you know, it's basically blood money and
the banality of evil.
Yes. This came to light obviously because a lot of research is being done into the Holocaust at the moment, because a new Holocaust museum is about to open. So what's the news on that?
Yes, on Sunday, Israel President Yitzhak Herzog will be at the opening of the National Holocaust Museum in Amsterdam. It's just ridiculous, by the way, that it took so long for the Netherlands to open a National Holocaust Museum, by the way. He will be accompanied by King Willem-Alexander, who will perform the opening ceremony. Herzog's visit is part of a two-day trip to the Netherlands and had been kept secret for security reasons, but it leaked out via an Israeli news site. His visit is now also confirmed by the museum itself. Herzog first of all represents the homeland of the many Dutch Holocaust survivors who emigrated to Israel after World War II to build a new future, the museum said in a statement. But it also went on to say it is bitter that the museum is being opened while the war in Israel and Gaza is ongoing. However, we expect a dignified ceremony that will do justice to the significant national and international importance of our museum, the statement said. Prime Minister Mark Rutte, Austrian Chancellor Alexander van der Bellen, the chairwoman of the German Bundesrat Manuela Schwesig will also attend the ceremony. Both Austria and Germany have paid towards the cost of the museum. Palestinian right groups The Rise Forum has described Herzog's attendance and meeting with the king as a slap in the face for the Palestinians who are watching helplessly as Israel murders their loved ones and destroys their country.
Yeah.
So,
there's almost certain to be protests out there in Amsterdam this weekend. And of course, I've noticed in the context of the election campaign as well, Geert Wilders has been tweeting an awful lot about Israel lately seemingly taking a very very firmly standing on mm-hmm. the side of Israel while it's being criticized by other parties. Again, not taking a particularly diplomatic point of view. Sports news this week, and we're going to focus on a question that's exercising the finest minds in football and criminal justice. Where in the world is Quincy Promes?
I'm wondering that myself. I my first guess would be Russia.
Yes.
But then I know that he went to Dubai or the United Arab Emirates, not to dredge some sand into the sea to build some palm islands, but
not to go and work for Boscalis, or perhaps to transport some a large shipment of cocaine. But the 32-year-old former Ajax winger, he was missing from Spartak Moscow's game with Zenit St. Petersburg at the weekend, and that's because he is currently, seemingly, we think, in Dubai, where he'd gone to a training camp with his teammates at Spartak Moscow. But then he was detained. He wasn't allowed to fly home to Russia because apparently he'd fled the scene of a traffic accident while he was out in Dubai. So yes, not the most clever move, you've got to say, when you're in Dubai, and of course also there's an arrest warrant for you, because Quincy Promes, of course, recently was sentenced to 6 years in jail for his part in smuggling 1300 kilograms of cocaine into Antwerp, and he has separately received an 18-month sentence for stabbing his cousin at a family party.
So the Netherlands does have an extradition treaty with the United Arab Emirates. Ever since Ridwan Taghi was arrested there, will he be extradited or not?
Yeah, well, that is the burning question. And when it was first revealed that he'd been detained in Dubai, immediately there was speculation in the Dutch media that perhaps the prosecution service could ask for his extradition. Seemingly he was trapped, but it now looks as if he may well slip through the net again. He was arrested and questioned by Dubai police, but at the weekend he was filmed out in a Dubai nightclub by his girlfriend, which I don't think would have gone down terribly well with a lot of people in the Netherlands, particularly his family members who were who were involved in that stabbing incident. It now looks as if Promes has been placed under house arrest in Dubai. He is due to appear in court next week. He is likely to receive a fine, and it seems as if once he's paid the money and he's not short of a bob or two, he'll be allowed to get back on a plane to Russia.
And why exactly wouldn't Dubai send him back to the Netherlands?
Well, it's all very murky and unclear, because we don't even know if there's been an extradition request. The prosecution service have said that they were aware that he was in Dubai and they had spoken to officials in the UAE. On the face of it, there's no reason why they couldn't request extradition, given the severity of the crimes he's been convicted of and the length of the jail sentences. But as a lawyer explained to our day this week, extradition proceedings have a habit of becoming political cases, especially when they involve high-profile figures and, of course, two countries that don't have much love for each other, which is the case with Russia and the Netherlands.
Dubai has all the interests not to get in the middle of this.
Yes, and Dubai just wants a nice, easy process. The local crime that he's accused of is a road traffic incident. I don't think the person the other person who was in the accident was killed, so they can simply say that he can pay a fine and leave, and basically it's an opportunity for Russia to rub the Dutch government's noses in the dirt by saying, we've got this guy that you want to send to prison, and we're going to bring him back to Moscow where you can't touch him, because of course there is no Russia will not extradite Quincy Promes. In fact, they're more likely than ever now probably to give him a passport.
I just hope that there will be an international diplomatic drama centered around Quincy Promes. I would love to see that happening. So that's Quincy Promes, a footballer, of course, but is there any other football news of note?
Yes, there is. PSV came back to draw 2-2 at home to Feyenoord in the table topper last Sunday with an equaliser by Guus Til, and that keeps Peter Bosz's side 10 points clear in the Eredivisie with 10 matches to play, so basically they're going to win. The bottom end of the table, all four clubs at the wrong end lost, so Fallen Dumb, who've won just once since the start of October now, are still 3 points behind Vitesse. In Europe, PSV played the second leg of their Champions League last 16 match in Dortmund on Wednesday, while Ajax, they were the only other survivors in Europe now. They drew 0-0 at home to English side Aston Villa in the Conference League on Thursday, and they played the second leg next week as well.
And it's also been a good week for Dutch athletes on the track.
It has. The Dutch team won more medals at the World Indoor Championships in Glasgow than any nation apart from the United States. I believe impressive. They got, they got gold medals as well as 3 jelly beans and a quarter cup of of supermarket lemonade. I think the World Indoor Championships were slightly more prestigious event than the Willy Wonka chocolate experience or whatever it was.
Slightly. Though I saw that at the start of the race they had to walk through some sort of magic tunnel before they entered the stadium, and that reminded me a little bit of the Glasgow Willy Wonka experience. I thought that must be the same organizer.
Perhaps they used the same set. Yeah, the same props. Inevitably Famke Bol was involved in both gold medals. She won the individual 400 meters title in a world record time of 49.17 seconds, and that was her third world record over the distance indoors. Lieke Klaver took the silver medal, a full second behind, and then the two women teamed up on the final day as one half of the 4x400 meter relay team, with Bol bringing the baton home on the anchor leg. The men's team claimed a bronze in their relay, but the first medalist was actually Sophie Doctor in the pentathlon, who won bronze as well. But it wasn't all plain sailing for the Dutch team. Nadine Visser was one of the favourites to win the 60 metres hurdles, but she clattered the first barrier in her semi-final and ran in last, and that was the end of her hopes.
That's unfortunate. And speaking of successes on the track, Max Verstappen is back in the driver's seat, and he had some success in Bahrain.
Yes, the opening Grand Prix of the season confirmed what everyone long suspected, which is that the only way Verstappen is going to lose his championship title is if he starts taking driving tips from Quincy Promes.
Well, he is nearby, so yeah, he can just...
They're both in the same part of the world, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, maybe he'll drop in and visit him. Yeah, give him a lift back to Moscow. I don't know.
And maybe they can build sandcastles with Boscalis.
Verstappen absolutely strolled the opening Grand Prix of the season. It seems like an insult to even call it a race. He took pole position, he led from start to finish, he crossed the line 22 seconds clear of his own Red Bull teammate Sergio Perez, and he set the fastest lap, just for good measure. So the procession to the title has begun, and the only real question is whether Verstappen will beat last season's total of 19 race wins. And there is an extra Grand Prix this season, 23 altogether. It's going to be a very long season. It'll feel long unless you're an absolute diehard Verstappen fan. And every chance he will win even more races than last year.
I just can only say that I hope that it will be a bit more exciting than last year and the year before that. But yeah, the reality is probably that it will be just as boring as last year. And that's just a shame.
Yeah, and it's not Verstappen's fault that he's got the best car and the other teams aren't able to keep up. This is up to them to close the gap.
Even though there is a lot of drama going on in this team, and hopefully that will lead to some, a decrease in his speed. I don't think that will happen, but let's hope that it will be a bit more exciting than last year.
Yeah, well, I mean, if Christian Horner has the same effect on Red Bull as Marc Overmars had on Ajax, then it could actually the margins could start to close. You're right.
We can only hope. Red Bull, also an Austrian team, right? So a lot of Austria in this podcast.
There is.
Yeah, I saw that you called it this item the Euro papagai pim pam petje, and I couldn't let that slide. So I think that's just going to be our episode title.
Yes.
The Netherlands entry for this year's Eurovision Song Festival in Malmo is a mainly Dutch language song with a hardcore beat. And singer Joost Klaun says it is an ode to his father. Klein was selected from more than 600 entries to represent the Netherlands, and the number was described by the selection committee as a hit that can take over Europe. Hardcore DJ Paul Elstak was also involved in the composition. It's kind of a letter to my father, Klein told TV presenter Arjen Lubach during an afternoon edition of his popular evening show. He taught me that the world has no borders. And Klein lost both his parents as a teenager and ends the promotional video with a tribute to them. In January, Klein won the Netherlands' biggest popular music award, the Pop Prize 2023. He had a number one hit last summer in Germany, Austria. It's almost, we have to pay reparations to these countries.
I think pay reparations to Austria, yeah, certainly, for, yeah, the, for this, yeah, podcast. Yeah.
And he had also a number one hit in Switzerland with his happy hardcore track, Friesenjung. Mm. Is that in German? It was probably a song in German then, I think.
It's certainly a German title, yeah.
Yeah. Klein will be on stage in the second half of the second semi-final of Eurovision, and it is an absolute hit in the Netherlands. Yeah. I think it was the most streamed song ever on Spotify the day after it came out. It is also picking up steam at the bookmakers. When it was released, it was at the bottom, at level Vitesse, but it is slowly finding its way in the bookmakers lists, and I think right now it's number 3.
It's a nice style revival then.
It's almost it's running faster in through the ranks than Femke Bol and Max Verstappen combined. I personally don't like the song at all.
It's Eurovision, isn't it? And I think it's a lot of Eurovision is about capturing the mood, and you see, and maybe, you know, at the time there's a lot of misery and anguish and war in the world, and a sort of an upbeat, light, Europoppy hardcore song is what people will go for. I don't know. I think it's a good catchy tune. It's I think it could do quite well. It's certainly the sort of thing, if you've ever had Dutch builders working in your house, it will sound very familiar.
You should hire people from abroad if you want to avoid this kind of music. I hate the song, but I do think that it is a potential winner, because it has, what you say, all the elements that Eurovision voters with their esteemed taste like. He also sings about a number of other European countries, right? In their respective languages, so that is also...
There's a few words of French and German in there, isn't there? And of course, it's about open borders as well, which is... There's clearly a message there, especially if we've just had an election which was dominated by parties who want to close the borders. So there's a bit of a message in there. And it's quite poignant and nice at the end, isn't it? With the last of 20 seconds, I think, of the video are a tribute to his parents who he lost when he was young. So yeah, I think it's got the ingredients to do well.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it is a potential winner. So maybe we can, if ASML is moving from Veldhoven, or where are they? They have a huge factory that's empty over there. Maybe they can use it as a venue for the next Eurovision Song Contest in 2025.
That's all we have for you this week. This podcast is a production of Dutch News, which can be found online at dutchnews.nl. We will include links to everything we've talked about today in the liner notes. You can get us in touch with us by email to podcast@dutchnews.nl. And if you want to help us out, please subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating. And you can also now back us on Patreon at patreon.com/dutchnewsnl and earn yourself a free shout out on the podcast. My thanks to Paul Peters. I'm Gordon Derrick, and we're wrapping up with a tribute to the Jost Klein and the Air Raid Siren, a beautiful remix, and a tribute to things that will soon be lost to us forever. We'll be back next week.
Yeah, hopefully with less sound effects. Fuck, what was it? I've seen it.
Have you?
It had a ridiculous reason. Yeah, that, I will try Bayonair, and otherwise I don't know. It's fuck.
You can't find it. It's really buggy now.
Yeah, it's annoying that I can't find it.